Sector at 5. Police have revealed gunman Derek Bird killed 10 of his 12 victims in little more than an hour. Chief Constable Craig Mackey has confirmed the first to die was his twin brother David in the early hours of Wednesday morning. His next victim was his solicitor Kevin Commons, who was shot dead in his own driveway. Bird then embarked on a 45-mile round trip across Cumbria, killing as he went.
The second phase of his shootings took place between 10:30 a.m. and 11:35, while Mr. Bird was on the run, and he went on to kill another 10 innocent people.
The Prime Minister's been in Cumbria talking to those who survived the deadly shooting rampage by Derek Bird. David Cameron has described local people as incredibly brave. England's World Cup preparations have been badly disrupted by the news Rio Ferdinand will almost certainly miss the tournament. The captain injured his left knee during the opening training session just 7 days before the start of the competition. Former skipper Terry Butcher says it leaves a big hole in the team.
He's a leader. He's been highly quoted about what he thinks about this World Cup, no excuses and all this kind of thing, and making amends for previous debacles. So, for him to be out is a hammer blow.
A chef's been jailed for at least 20 years for killing his wife with a griddle pan while she was sleeping, then hiding her body in a freezer for 3 years. Peter Warner had claimed he killed Melanie at their home in Surrey in 2006 in self-defence during a row. Oil and tar gushing from a ruptured pipeline in the Gulf of Mexico has now come ashore in Florida. Authorities say it's happened on Pensacola Beach, crowded with holidaymakers and swimmers. Tourism's worth £40 billion a year to the state. Thousands of fishermen are already trying to work under severe restrictions in Louisiana. And Prince William's opened the new Help for Heroes facilities at the military's top rehabilitation centre. The £11 million complex is at Headley Court in Surrey. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Arnold Services. Don't miss the opportunity. If you are employed and do extra hours work, bank shifts or overtime, including a second job, you are likely to have overpaid taxes. If you don't fall into any of these categories, you are still likely to have overpaid taxes based on your job expenses. We act as tax agents and can claim back £800 to £1,100 and up to £3,000 if you have never claimed before. Telephone 0845 544 0834. Visit marnor.net. M-A-R-N-O-R. Email admin@marnor.net.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling and my guest this week to review the week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Liberal Democrat councillor for Cotton and a new arrival on the city's cabinet, Anthony Negus. Martin Summers, the old Labour political pundit and economist, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, two Bristolians caught up in this week's attack on a flotilla of small ships taking medical and building aid from Cyprus through the blockade of Gaza, are due home this weekend. As film of the small ships being boarded by commandos went out on the television, it was difficult not to make the comparison with the little ships of Dunkirk for the 50th anniversary at the same time. We hear from Dr. Judith Brown, an expert on the media coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Also after six, the BBC Online called it the world's most powerful secret society. And it's the annual Bilderberg Club weekend. This year it's taking place in Spain. That is royalty, the IMF, the World Bank, Henry Kissinger, maybe the new Lord Chancellor, Kenneth Clark, is there too. No press are allowed in within a mile of the meeting, but reporters for The Economist magazine are inside, sworn to never mention in the magazine where they hear what they hear. So that's after the news at 6 o'clock. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, averaging 20 degrees Celsius in the daytime, sunnier on Saturday, a little bit more cloudy on Sunday. Some rain, though, also on Sunday morning. Next week, averaging 16 Celsius in the daytime, getting cooler and cloudier as the week goes on. Main bouts of rain will be on Tuesday and Friday. They look rather showery. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of June, averaging temperature is going down again. It's down to about 13 Celsius, fairly dry, but sunnier on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now. With me is Liberal Democrat Councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Hi, Anthony, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Pleased to be here.
Now, first of all, you're a new boy on the Cabinet. So does it feel like going to big school now? Because you've been a councillor for a while, but now you've actually been invited to join the Cabinet.
Well, I was elected to join the Cabinet, and it's something I wanted to do. It was a chance to be much more involved in how the city works and how we can actually bring forward improvements and make the lives of Bristol taxpayers rather better. And I wanted to be a part of that process, so I'm very pleased to be here.
So what's your portfolio on the Cabinet then?
Well, a bit of a mouthful. It's called Strategic Housing and Regeneration, and that covers the general housing portfolio, all aspects of involvement for the City Council with housing, and planning, urban design and regeneration.
But do you feel like maybe you've drawn the short straw there? Because it's ever such a difficult one, isn't it? We've got over 20,000 registered homeless people in Bristol. So how are we going to house them?
Well, I think I've been extremely lucky. It was very close to being my dream ticket. I'm an architect and much more recently took a secondary degree in conservation architecture. So I know a bit about planning, I know a bit about design and creativity and actually managed to drive solutions forward. So that was a fantastic opportunity for me to get much more involved in something I know about and love very much. But the housing side of it also gives me a chance to actually meet people and feel that I'm doing real good to real people. Now, it is a tough ask, and it is a big portfolio. In fact, all the portfolios are very big. There's a great deal to be done. There are only 8 Cabinet members, and we have to share the responsibilities for the whole of Bristol City Council between us. So I'm not whinging about that. But the housing one does give me a great deal of scope. I also know something about it, from the design and architectural point of view. But from the people point of view, it's a tremendous opportunity to get involved.
Now, before the election, it was Mark Wright's job, I think. Yeah. Is there going to be some continuity between what you were doing and what he's doing?
Well, I sincerely hope so. Mark and I sit right opposite each other, as close as I am to you here in our own shared room. And Mark has been very helpful and that's worked very well. Whenever I've struggled with something, I simply don't understand, or I need a guide, or Mark's there to assist.
But it's a real tall order, isn't it, getting the housing situation sorted? Because we have all sorts of pressure on the Greenbelt, which there's a lot of resistance to, quite understandably. So how are you going to squeeze those extra houses in?
Well,
we've set
our face against building on the Greenbelt, and we've made that quite clear. We have a number of strategies in Bristol, some of which are presently being redrafted and sent out again for consultation and for approval. And we have said that we are not intending to build on the Greenbelt. We have set a figure of 30,000 houses within Bristol, within the Bristol area, which doesn't include building on the Greenbelt. That has been contested under something called the Regional Spatial Strategy. That's now just been scrapped by the new coalition government, and that gives us an advantage. It also gives us a problem, and that's something we've got to work around at the moment. I'm just feeling my way on some of this.
So whereabouts are these new houses going to go then? I know there's a big new development planned in St Paul's on the old cardboard factory site. It's it's like a giant great building site there at
the
moment.
Well, we're starting with brownfield sites and sites that have which are sites that have already been built on that we can actually develop without too much taking away of very precious space in Bristol. But we're also going through a number of other exercises. One is the garage strategy, where we're looking at building affordable housing on small sites which have been for garages in council estates. They've been very difficult to maintain, and they're very cost ineffective, and they're not used very much. So we've taken those on board and are presently getting those underway. The first one is actually coming out of the ground when I visited it 2 weeks ago. So that's a very good result. And we're also bringing forward something called the Green Spaces and the Site Allocations Policy. And this is a consultation document where we've asked everybody in Bristol, starting in autumn 2008, what sites in their area could be used for anything at all. And a lot of people have said that they're to be retained as green spaces or for other uses, but some of them are possible to be used for housing. We've actually assembled a document now which is just about to go out to consultation. There's going to be a press release next week about it.
Now, people are obviously very concerned if there are green spaces near them or little bits of, maybe even things like pubs, because quite a lot of those have been given planning permission for housing now. Mm. You know, this is there's always the pressure for reducing the sort of shared space and community space. Yes. So if people have got concerns about your plans, how will they get to know about this consultation and how can they feed into it?
Well, that will all be when it's launched next. It comes out for consultation on the 14th, which is Monday week. There's a press launch. We're meeting the press next Friday, so that's a new experience for me as well. That will then prepare that document for release on the Monday. It will be there will be drop-in opportunities for people to go and see all the documents. They're obviously available on the website, people can comment, and in fact we warmly invite further comment. We had a massive number of sites that came out of that thing. It's been whittled down to 119, and those are still waiting for people to comment on and to produce their ideas and their own thoughts about their local area.
Okay, away from Bristol now and up to Westminster, because your party's involved in this coalition government at the moment.
Indeed.
Cameron and Clegg, the marriage, can it last?
Well, it's designed to last. There are clever structures within the deal to make it last, and there is some sense in that, because it would be very easy to cut and run if things didn't quite work out. We actually, I think, and I'm speaking now, we is friends and colleagues around the Bristol area. I mean, I was involved, like everybody else, in fighting the elections earlier, a couple of months ago. And we've been, our best result would have been a Liberal Democrat government, obviously. And we would have been very prepared to stick by everything that was said in the manifesto that went out for that. That was not possible, and as a result, we think we've come up with the best result for the country with the what came out of Election Day. We've had to make something out of what the public were saying, and at this time, it isn't any good just to cobble something together and get it going for another election very, very shortly. We've got big problems in this country which have got to be addressed over a long period of time, so it's got to stick. And we the deal that's been made between us, and it's been issued in a very long document, so it's quite well set out, is there to make sure that we actually have a series of policies that we get through and will take us through 5 years to make sure we can deliver some real progress.
But don't you think some voters may just feel simply betrayed, since one of the main issues, which is to do with the potential cuts in public services? Vince Cable, before the election, was making absolutely clear that it was not the right time to cut because it could mean that this would actually deepen the recession. And now, of course, Vince has had to change his tune, hasn't he? So do you think you're going to pay at the polls in the next election for this pact?
The economic side of what we're doing is something which I think I have personally, I speak personally, have some concerns about. Vince is an entirely honourable man. I think he was one of the people that everybody in Parliament, along, sadly, with David Laws, felt were really absolutely made for what they're meant to be doing and have got most things right. It is hard to see how we can square that problem, but we are in a coalition. We have to make accommodations to get through this. My concern is, I mean, cuts will have to be made. Of course they will. Every party acknowledged that. We actually in our manifesto showed more than most exactly where those cuts would fall, and we were more honest than all of the others. But the fact is that if this isn't handled carefully, then there is the risk of driving deeper into the one thing which I think is going to solve this problem, which is recovery. And we have to be very careful of that. And if anyone's going to watch that very carefully, it's going to be Vince Cable.
Now, also joining us is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, George Osborne this week handed over the power to regulate the banking system to the Governor of the Bank of England, effectively ending the role for the old Financial Services Authority. What's the significance of this, and do you think this is the right move?
Well, it's sort of, from where I sit, which is a long way from making policy, it's a bit like moving deck chairs around on the Titanic, really. Whoever regulates, the question is what is the regulations going to be? The FSA was a creation of the last government, and has obviously, you know, in many ways shown itself perhaps not to be fit for purpose. But whether the Bank of England is the place for this to sit is another question again. From where I look at it, it's more a question of what regulations are we going to put in place rather than who's going to do the regulating. You know, we need to get some clarity about all of this.
But come on, Martin, if you had your choice, who would you like to see and how would you like to see the city regulated, if not...
Well, I was never happy with the Bank of England as an independent central bank. So the idea that they should then regulate the financial markets without overall political control of the Bank of England is questionable from my point of view. I think we need a completely different regulatory structure from the one we've had. In actual fact, the way I see it, that's why I'm a member of the Labour Party and I'm supposed to be a member of the Liberal Party. I think that the solutions to this crisis lead beyond the current capitalist setup, and that may sound strange and rather anachronistic.
You can't change the system, Martin.
Well, I'm afraid the system has basically imploded, and therefore there isn't really much of an option but to change it. We're still like cartoon characters having walked off the edge of a cliff and not looked down. This is a fundamental mess up that's been made here, and tinkering, there will be a whole period of tinkering. People like a quiet life, we'll carry on tinkering for a bit longer, but I see this crisis developing in much more serious ways, and that's what the test is going to be for the coalition or anybody else who is in power. I think we are really being challenged here. The banking system has collapsed and pulled down everything else with it, so this whole idea of cutting public services to rescue the banks, which is what we're effectively doing,
but it hasn't collapsed. We've propped it up,
we've propped it up for the time being. But that doesn't mean that we've ended the crisis. We've shifted the debts from the private sector to the public sector, and now we've got a public sector debt crisis which originated in the private sector. But we're not going to solve the problem by cutting back public expenditure.
Martin, one of the very few first things that New Labour did was to separate the Bank of England from the system, and it was one of the first things, I'm sure you're aware, that the Liberal Democrats were very happy about. Over the last few years, while we've been banging on for a very long time about the crisis that was coming and being ignored and laughed at and shouted down by your party and others, we've seen that the Bank of England has under the governor has usually been right in the way that he's needs to tackle the regulation problem. Now, I agree with you. We've got to get the terms of the regulation are, but I still think the safest pair of hands to do that is the Bank of England.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, given the situation that we're in. Mm. And of course, I mean, the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, Danny Blanchflower was calling it right, in my view, and the others were calling it wrong. But in a sense, there's a problem of accountability, though. If you've got an independent central bank, basically is answerable to the financial sector. It's not under direct political control. The Federal Reserve in the United States is effectively a private enterprise at the heart of the financial system, run by the banks. So the banks are effectively regulating themselves. And we have the problem of regulatory capture. The Bank of England is ostensibly a public institution, but it's many of its insiders are very close to the city, and these questions are ultimately political questions, and in the old days they were decided at a political level.
I think they should be decided politically. I have no particular problem with that, but the fact is that under the previous regime, with where the financial control was dealt so-called independently under the review of the government, the government took their eye off the ball. They didn't allow that regulatory that function to work properly.
Let me make this clear. I don't actually agree with a lot of what the previous government did.
Okay.
I mean, I'm an old Labour activist.
Okay.
I'm still in the Labour Party, but with some reservations.
Right.
I'm not here to defend their record.
Okay.
Because they bought into all of this stuff just as much as anybody else.
We can agree on that one, then. That's grand.
Okay, folks, we're going to go on to review some of this week's stories in a moment. But first of all, just to announce that Bristol City Council is running a survey at the moment for anyone who was affected badly by the local elections. In other words, if you had any problems voting, if you got the wrong voting papers or anything, the council are asking for web contributions. I imagine you can phone them up on 922 2000 if you're not on the internet, because I'm sure there are ways of contributing if you're not on the internet, from the council website. They're collecting feedback from voters until the 18th of June via an online form. And I know there was a meeting this afternoon. I don't know if you were at that, Anthony, were you? There was a meeting this afternoon at the City Council just for candidates and election agents, and we hope to have a report on that next week. But if anyone had any problems with the voting in the recent elections at the beginning of May, there's the election monitoring form. Please do go onto the council website and fill it out before the 18th of June. Now, first of all, let's have a look at this week's stories. One of the big stories of the week we've had two Bristol people involved in, which is the blockade of Gaza and the attempt by a small flotilla of boats coming from Cyprus, mostly Turkish registered boats, to break the blockade. Now, of course, the and international waters, some Israeli commandos actually attacked the blockade, and so we're going to hear now from ex ambassador to Uzbekistan and also the head of the maritime policy unit at the Foreign Office, Craig Murray, speaking at a rally which took place on Monday earlier this week in London.
A great sorrow, because a score of our fellow peace activists lie dead, murdered by the Israeli army. Today is a day when we have failed to see the international condemnation of the most severe sort, which should be emanating from my old office in the Foreign Office behind you, and we have not seen it strongly enough. We have seen the European Union call for an inquiry. I can tell you this, 20 of our colleagues are dead. That is a fact. At the end of the inquiry, 20 of our colleagues will still be dead. What use is your bloody inquiry? We don't need it. Let me tell you this. I used to be the head of the Foreign Office Maritime Section. What Israel did in boarding a foreign ship in international waters is an act of illegal war, plain and simple. But let me also tell you this. In international waters, the law which applies is the law of the flag state of the ship on which the incident takes place. So those Israeli soldiers must be taken to Turkey and tried for murder in Turkey under Turkish law. And we must not forget that the cause of this incident is Zionism, because under Zionism there can be no peace. There cannot be peace with a philosophy which claims a divine right to occupy somebody else's territory and a divine justification for murder. Zionism is bullshit! We do not accept Zionism. We do not accept Israel's behavior. We do not accept the continual existence of an Israeli embassy in London. And we are now going to march on the Israeli embassy. Thank you.
That was former Ambassador Craig Murray there. Apologies for the swearing, but that was what he said in Trafalgar Square on Monday this week. Now, first, with you, Martin, could you just tell us what your reaction is to the attack on which took place on Monday this week on this flotilla?
Well, like most right-thinking people, I'm appalled, as is Craig Murray. I mean, obviously, the emotions are running high there. His language is slightly emotive.
But he's going over the top in a way, don't you think? Because he's saying Zionism is not legitimate.
Well, I mean, that's a legitimate, that is a legitimate point of view, but I would suggest that the way in which he was putting the case there was slightly emotive. But then it's an emotive, it's an emotive occasion. Let's face it, people are dead. It's a pretty bad situation, and people are angry. And some of that came across in the style as well as the substance of what Craig was saying there.
Now, Anthony, just moving over to you, it's interesting, but the City Council has actually put forward a motion, I believe. And who is, how is that happening, and roughly what does it say?
Steve Comer has put together a motion condemning the events of last week, of earlier this week, and I've, along with some other people, have made some comment on that, and we are expecting that to go to council at the next full council meeting.
But do you think this is something that Bristol City Council should be getting involved with, because the Israelis are simply saying that all they're doing is defending themselves?
Yes, that's a reasonable point, and I'm concerned about the way that we're concentrating on states here. I think that the problem that we're seeing is ordinary people, ordinary Palestinians, ordinary Israelis, I guess, ordinary Turkish people and people from other countries, not necessarily representing states or stateship, but those people are being damaged, killed, and disadvantaged by what is an unholy mess in this part of the world. And the rest of the world is disengaging itself because it doesn't, it's a much bigger issue than what's happening on the border between these two countries. Now, that's bad enough, but when some states identify Gaza as being not a credible state, and the Israelis is being driven with other motives other than just defending a border, they're not going to engage fully. We're not going to get committed to solving this problem. And it's going to be a problem that can only be solved internationally.
Now, the man we just heard from, the ex-ambassador Craig Murray, is a vociferous blogger, probably one of the most famous bloggers in the country. And I was just checking out his blog today, where he's saying he's been talking to people in NATO, and he says, NATO headquarters in Brussels is today a very unhappy place. There's a strong understanding amongst the various national militaries that an attack by Israel on a NATO member flagged ship in international waters is an event to which NATO is obliged, legally obliged, as a matter of treaty, to react. What do you make of that, Martin?
Well, I mean, that may well be the case. I mean, it's certainly, the geopolitics of this incident are very sharp. The Turkish government is clearly very, very unhappy. This is the Erdogan government in Turkey, which is a moderate elected Islamist government. But of course, I just mentioned, for the benefit of our listeners who listen every week, of course, what's the ongoing investigations in Turkey into Ergonekon, which was a secret network based in the armed forces, which has been uncovered now by the Turkish police. Top Turkish generals are under arrest, facing charges of fomenting terrorism in Turkey over 30 years. So most of the terrorism in Turkey, left, right and Islamist, over the last 30 years, the police in Turkey are now suggesting that was run from inside their own armed forces, which of course are part of the integrated NATO command. The point about this is that the democratic government of Turkey is now getting control of its own security apparatus and changing the geopolitics of its position. So they worked with Brazil to bring forward this Iranian nuclear deal, which was made the Americans and the Israelis unhappy. And also the Turkish government are now saying that if further Turkish ships go into Gaza, they will go with destroyer escorts from the Turkish Navy. Now, this is a very big change from Turkey's traditional alliance with Israel. But, of course, it's the Turkish military's traditional alliance with Israel. The Turkish people have never been very happy with it.
Now, as you know, there's a vigil that takes place down in the city centre opposite the Hippodrome every day.
Yes, Martin. And there's going to be a demonstration tomorrow at 3 p.m. about this opposite the Hippodrome. I believe that Seki Yildirim and Cliff Hanley will be coming back from Turkey on Monday, or Sunday or Monday, I believe. We were talking about this last night. At the moment, they're going to the funerals of the people who were murdered in Turkey.
Because when anything happens in Palestine, Afghanistan or whatever, it seems that this is a focal point, really. People kind of converge in the city centre between 5
yes,
and 6.
Yes, I mean, but there's been a vigil every night this week from 5, as there always is. There's been a vigil in the centre of Bristol ever since September the 11th, 2001. Lois Atherden who is the pensioner who's been the most stalwart member of that vigil. I'll just name check her. She's quite a famous Bristolian these days. She's there every day saying hoop for peace, and she gets lots of support.
Okay, so anyway, I went down to the vigil yesterday evening to have a chat with some of the members there, people who were waving placards and that kind of thing, just to see, and really just basically ask them why they were there.
My name's Ian, and I'm here because, as a human being, I've a duty to try and stop suffering of people who just don't deserve it.
I'm Julie Boston, and I'm here to oppose what Israeli government is doing.
I'm Tony Purnell, and I'm absolutely disgusted with the way that the people on the Freedom Convoy were set upon by a load of thugs from Israel.
But they're saying, the Israeli government, that these people were representatives, really, of terrorist groups in Turkey.
Yes, well, they've lied before, haven't they? They're always lying, aren't they? You know, these were people who are fighting for humanity, for the freedom of the people in Palestine. And the problem with our media these days is that it tries to equate Israel with Palestine. And Israel is the oppressor and the occupier, and Palestine are the victims. And Palestine are deprived of everything that we take for granted. And they get nothing of that. And that's why we're stood here protesting that they should be treated as human beings like the rest of us.
Alan, I'm here to protest against the totally outrageous killing of civilians, violation of international waters by a state that doesn't seem to be restrained by any sense of morality.
But Netanyahu has said that these people, some of the people anyway, who are on this Turkish ship particularly, were representatives of terrorist groups based in Turkey.
I doubt that. They even had Henning Mankell, the author of Wallander, on the boat. This seems like more Israeli lies.
My name is Mohammed. I'm a medical student, and I'm studying in Bristol. I'm pro-Palestinian, so I'm just supporting this activity every day.
But the Israelis are saying that they were just literally protecting themselves.
The flotilla is on international water, so they can't say that they are protecting themselves because they are boarding the ship, and by law, these people on the ship can defend themselves and repel these boarders. So they can't say that the Israelis are trying to defend themselves.
My name is Ridwan, and I'm here to show my support to Palestine, and because I'm totally disagree with what Israel done towards people of Palestine and the people of the from the humanitarian aid.
Yeah. Okay, because the Israelis are saying that they were really just literally protecting themselves from what could have been terrorists from Turkey.
I don't think so, because it's clearly because I know that all of the staff in that boat already checked by Four Nations, and there's no way that there's terrorists there. And I hear that there are few Israelis in the boat itself, so it shouldn't be any weapon in the boat. Yeah.
Well, voices there of those people down at the peace vigil opposite the Hippodrome in the city centre here in Bristol, which goes on every week, doesn't it, Martin, between 5 and 6? Isn't it on Saturday too? Hang on a second. Say that again.
On Saturday there's normally a vigil at 3, but this Saturday there's a call for a demonstration, and that's what the call has gone out for.
Okay, now let's on to some of the other stories around. Now, first of all, Bristol's managed to make the national news this week with an £18,000 council job, which you can't apply for if you're white. Council, that is Bristol City Council, was accused of discrimination after whites were barred from applying for two £18,000 a year jobs. Bristol City has created the management training posts for graduates in an effort to recruit more minority employees. Now, Anthony, this almost seems like discrimination in the opposite direction, and possibly even racism.
Oh, certainly not racism, but and that's a term which it really wouldn't apply in this case. What we're trying to do is to really put our money where our mouth is. We've been talking for a very long time about a balance in the way that we treat people, and there's an imbalance in our workforce, which is we're the largest employer in the region, And we are 7% of our workforce is from BME community, and in fact, 12% of the population of Bristol is BME. And it seems when we have the opportunity to actually do something and show what we really mean, this is just the sort of time when we should actually show that.
But it's one thing, isn't it, making a particular job appeal, I mean, for example, advertising in BME newspapers, but when it comes down to it, surely it's up to the panel to decide on the best candidate. And isn't it a little bit patronising to say, well, you're actually only doing this job because of the colour of your skin?
Yes, the patronising thing is a worry, and in fact it also applies when grants are given out to particular interest groups or BME communities or whatever, because I fear that can be seen as making them a special case and therefore highlighting their difference. What we're very keen to do in the long term is to close down that difference, is to integrate everybody and make everybody part of one community. And this is an attempt on behalf of our group through Bristol City Council to try and integrate people and get everybody on the same playing field.
Yeah, I mean, I would broadly agree with that. And I'd point out that these are management training jobs for £18,000 a year. They're not jobs. They're opportunities to be trained to a level to apply for the jobs. And presumably the jobs themselves will be absolutely straight. You know, if you're applying for a management post, there will be no extra bias in favour of being black or anything else.
As I understand it, no, these are time barred. They're jobs for 2 years, and then after that, there's a reapplication on a
exactly. So what you're trying to do is make sure that you've got a level playing field for everybody before you start the match.
Absolutely.
That's what this is about, and people shouldn't get this wrong. This is a trainee position to make sure that you've got enough trainees from a black minority ethnic community. Sometimes people don't know what BME means. Black minority ethnic communities, that when you actually do come to the proper match, as it were, it's absolutely a level playing field. And because we all know there's been historical discrimination against certain communities, and that's got to be addressed. I mean, by and large, there's a broad consensus about that in this country, and I think most sensible people welcome such a consensus.
Okay, thanks. Now, on to a national story to do with the Liberal Democrats. And this happened just in the, I think it was the Daily Telegraph, published on Saturday morning at the bank holiday, last bank holiday. David Laws hopes his constituents will allow a political comeback. This is the Liberal Democrat Chief Secretary to the Treasury, David Laws, who resigned on, I think, Saturday morning last week. And now, this is a little bit worrying, because this is a key position as part of this coalition, Anthony, and yet David Laws has felt it necessary to step down after only about 2 weeks in the job.
He's made his position very, very clear, and I have the utmost sympathy for him, because all the very things that he was trying to avoid have actually now broken over his head in a very short time, and it's desperately upsetting for him. He was made for this job, and that's not just within our party, but certainly he's had tremendous warmth and support from all across the House for his position, and a genuine sadness that he's had to stand down in this step. But he's taken the honourable course, and a lot of people have been kind enough to say that when all this is sorted out and the expenses review is done, that there will be an opportunity for him to come back, and I certainly hope so, because he's, alongside Vince Cable, he's absolutely perfectly placed to do this job.
Now, we have a bit of a precedent for this kind of thing with Mr. Mandelson, who was actually removed from office and then sort of hovered around, swooping around the sidelines, and then came back again. Do you think that's going to happen with David Laws? Because that's something I don't think the public really like. If someone's had to resign on a matter of principle, then it's not very good to then bring them back in again after people have had time to forget about it.
Well, it depends what comes out of the review that's done into the expenses, as I believe, and many people believe, that would be found to be a very, very low misdemeanor, and it's been explained why it was done. I mean, David Laws doesn't need £40,000. He was a millionaire when he was young. He chose to do this job because it was a job that he really wanted to do as a local constituency MP and involved in governmental finance.
But he was also claiming £120, the maximum per month utility bills, which you would maybe raise questions about whether he really needed all that as well.
Well, I really can't go into the detail of every of the minutiae of his claim because I simply don't know all the details, so it's wrong for me to comment. But I've met David Laws on three occasions. He's a very nice man. He's revered by all his colleagues and has a very, very high constituency standing as well. I'm sure that he's an honourable man. I'd be very surprised if he found to be doing anything that's wrong.
On a sort of sideline track off of this, don't you find that some of the Liberal Democrats are almost being used by the Conservatives to kind of deliver the bad news? We often see that, you know, when there's some really bad news from the coalition, it's a Liberal Democrat that has to step onto Newsnight or wherever to deliver this news.
It may be that they're just the most able people for those particular jobs, and that's the line I would assume.
Martin, what's your thoughts on what happened to David Laws?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I've got no interest in his sexuality as an issue, and the expenses issue, in my view, as we've said often on this programme, is massively overblown anyway and rather manipulated. David Laws is a millionaire, as Anthony's pointed out, as are 17 of the 23 members of the Cabinet. I think that the less well-off Britain is going to perceive this coalition as a coalition of the wealthy. We should not be cutting public... I know my party said in the election, or my party leaders said, that we should have to cut public expenditure sooner or later. I think they were wrong. I think that we're going to have to actually increase public expenditure if we're going to get out of the recession. And we're going to do it by basically making those who benefited from the bubble of the last 30 years pay for it. It's a national emergency. It's a bit like World War II. The wealthy classes are going to have to get out their checkbooks, and somebody has got to make them do that. We're not going to get to that stage of making them do that until people realise that this conventional way of cutting your way out of recession won't work. We live in a capitalist society. We're indoctrinated from a very young age that you can't have free lunch and all the rest of it. But the fact of the matter is that the millionaires and the billionaires who've benefited from this bubble, from this completely misallocation of resources by the market, those are the people who must pay. And if you try cutting frontline services to try and solve the problem, you'll find that the economy tanks out, your tax receipts go down, your welfare benefits go up, and just as in the early 1980s, it won't even cut the deficit. So even the one thing that's being touted as, well, we've got to cut the deficit, these policies won't even reduce the deficit.
My answer to that is that David Laws had every opportunity to continue to be an even greater millionaire had he wanted to, but he chose to do something which he felt was much more in the public domain and was helping local people.
I'm not denying that.
Sure. No, I know you're not. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just supporting what you're saying. But the answer to the other point about how do we actually tackle disadvantage and particularly massive advantage in this country, look to what we have managed in the coalition to get into the manifesto document. Those, the Liberal Democrat elements of what is in that manifesto, are the things that will actually make sure that this becomes a more equal society. And we'll keep pressing for that too.
But David Laws has defrauded the taxpayer of £40,000. How can he be, as Mr. Cameron says, an honourable man? And how can he then be sort of hovering around waiting to come back into politics again?
No, the issue is not about the £40,000. It's about the status of the person to whom the £40,000 was claimed over. Yes. And had that person been a spouse or a live-in partner, or I can't think of all the terms, then there would have been it would have been very clear. What David was trying to do was to obscure and maybe run very close to the definition of what that meant, so he did not have to reveal his sexuality, which as Martin said, is completely irrelevant to any of this. And it's just sad that in our society today that is still seen to be a problem.
Bristol recycling cheats could face £1,000 fine. Well, we all had all sorts of changes to the way the recycling services is happening in the city, with these doorstep recycling collections stepping up a few years ago. The main kind of waste rubbish collection, should I say, is only every 2 weeks now. But we hear that Bristol residents who ignore waste recycling rules could be hit with fines of up to £1,000. Proposals suggest that the Bristol City Council may target persistent offenders in a bid to increase recycling rates. The council will be keen to avoid the upcoming rises in the landfill tax, which is going up from £48 a tonne this year to £80 a tonne in 2014. And Councillor Gary Hopkins, who's in charge of waste, said the majority of people in Bristol are doing their bit. But apparently if they don't, £1,000 fine. Now, is this fair?
Anthony? Well, the word "may" is in there, and that's a very important word.
Because many of the people I've spoken to have problems with what is supposed to go where, what can be recycled, and what can't.
It really is pretty simple. The only two weekly collection is the black bin, which is the dry, clean waste. The brown bins for food waste, organic waste, food waste, and the black bins for paper and tin and glass are collected every week from everybody's doorstep, everybody's street step, if you like, that has been a success story. We have managed to reduce the amount of reduce the amount of waste that goes to landfill, and therefore save the taxpayers of Bristol a tremendous amount of money. Now that's taken a great deal of planning, a lot of pressure, a lot of pushing to get it to happen. It still isn't happening enough, and those people that are not doing this are actually imposing a cost on the taxpayers of the whole of Bristol, because what they're not putting into the right bins is going into landfill, maybe unnecessarily, but still going into landfill, and that's costing the whole of Bristol money. We have got to resolve this, and there are many, many ways we're trying to do it, with handbills and visits by waste doctors and advice centres and all sorts of things. My guess is if that ultimately does not work, and I have high expectations it will work, but if it doesn't work, then there may have to be some other consideration.
Because one of the big problems, of course, is language. I mean, we've got many languages spoken in the city, and not all of the different language communities actually understand exactly what they're supposed to be doing.
I'm not sure that that's a problem. I've actually canvassed on rubbish collection days all around the city, and in areas where language might be seen to be in a problem. There doesn't seem to be a particularly higher incidence of this, but most of these documents are put out in a range of languages anyway, and they're all available through the council services in other languages.
Well, obviously, if you're asking me, Tony, you pointed to me, but people can't see that out there in radio land. I would agree with this, that this is the kind of policy that needs to be pursued, but it's like nagging teenagers to tidy their bedrooms, isn't it? You just have to keep doing it.
OK, Brits sleep just 6 hours a night. This is from the Press Association at the beginning of the week. The average British adult sleeps for just 6 hours and 21 minutes a night, almost an hour less than 2 years ago, a study revealed. Money worries, work stress and noise were the top factors blamed for people failing to get the recommended 8 hours sleep. Research for Travel Lodge showed that more than half, I don't know how they did this research, what were the little cameras in people's rooms, I hope not, more than half of UK adults admitted being unable to concentrate in the office without a good night's rest, with a quarter of respondents confessing to have a sneaky nap at work. Well, what about you, Anthony? Do you have a sneaky nap at work?
I have never had a sneaky nap in my life, and I have to declare an interest. I actually only ever have 6 hours sleep. It's just the way it is. I don't get to bed until 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm usually up and around just after seven. So I've functioned that way for as long as I can remember. So I'm not too sure about the 8 hours, but if that's what people feel they need, well, they should have it.
Martin?
Well, I think what's interesting is the change, is that people are sleeping less in recent years. Less than 2 years ago. I mean, this is a symptom, I suspect, of the kind of stresses that our society is now coming under. People are worried about money, worried about the future, and that sort of thing impacts on things like sleep patterns. I mean, obviously, that's an anecdotal link, but it seems to be a common sense one. This is a sign of social stress.
Isn't this a sort of an economic thing as well, and to do with work practices and this kind of thing? Because so many more people in the family now are having to go out to work. I mean, you know, you've got most often husband and wife, or both partners actually having to go to work, and then also finding that their leisure time is eaten into by all sorts of other activities that they have to do, like sorting out the recycling, for example.
Well,
it just means that people have got less and less and less leisure time over the last 30 or 40 years.
Has anybody asked people why they are sleeping less? I mean, we've got records that they are, but have we gone further than that? Does the research actually ask why they're sleeping less?
No, I don't think so. It's just actually finding out how long people are sleeping.
Maybe it's because they're spending too much time lollaranding in chairs and watching television and playing video games rather than actually exercising and getting tired. But I don't know. They may be eating too many carrots.
But don't you think that there's some pressure on people's leisure time at the moment? I mean, I certainly, you know, feel that people are rushing about more, and they feel like they don't have so much time to themselves as they did, a few decades ago.
Well, that may be true, but I mean, I think we would have to actually drill down here a bit and find out what the reasons are. We can't just take an isolated incident and make lots of guesses as to what we'd like to think was the cause of it.
Well, drilling down a bit more into the Gulf oil spill, BP could face a ban as US launches a criminal investigation. Now, this has been going on and on for over a month now. What are your thoughts, Martin, as to how this might end? Are we going to see this Gulf oil spill capped by BP? And to what extent are they culpable?
Well, I mean, I am not a technical person, so I have no idea whether they're going to be able to stop it or not.
But should we be annoyed?
They don't seem to be able to, do they?
Do you think we should be pointing the finger at BP, or is this just an accident?
There's clear evidence that there was lack of regulation in this market, as in so many others. Basically, the philosophy has been in the last 30 or 40 years that industry knows best. The bonfire of red tape is now leading to a real disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Regulations are usually there for a reason. The idea that they are some kind of obstacle to business has been dinned into us. But in actual fact, proper regulation is essential for any real competition. If you think about a football match, the refereeing has got to be excellent at the highest levels, otherwise it all falls apart. And what we've allowed is self-refereeing, and that's why we've ended up in this kind of mess.
Well, the word criminal has been used, and that is a term that's coming in a lot of accident investigations and prosecutions these days. It seems that there is a line over which if you are careless, I'm choosing my words carefully, or not having resolved how you're going to deal with the problem once it's occurred. Accidents happen, but usually now there is a plan for how you deal with these things. If that's not been taken through to a reasonable extent, then I guess the word criminal cops up. What concerns me more, and I noticed the first bill has been sent by the US government to BP today, what concerns me more is the relationship that BP has with the pension funds in this country, and in fact in other countries, and that may well make an economic system which is tottering, certainly in Europe, considerably worse, or certainly put the fears under people to make it worse, and I think that's something we have to take into account.
Okay, now, Anthony, as you're the housing chap for Bristol, I've got a little interview here, which I didn't realise you were housing, but I've got an interview here with Paul Hazelden from the Crisis Centre Ministries, and he's got some points he wants to make about the lack of sheltered provision for homeless people, street sleepers, in the city.
I'm Paul Hazelden from the Crisis Centre in Bristol, and one of the absolute scandals of service delivery in Bristol. So there is no direct access provision for hostel accommodation 2 nights in every week. The Julian Trust opens on 5 nights a week, which means the remaining 2 nights on Thursdays and Sunday nights, there is absolutely nowhere to go if you are homeless in Bristol.
But surely the various different organisations can coordinate to make sure that there's somewhere else. Otherwise, you know, you've got a almost permanent population actually sleeping on the streets because there isn't anywhere to go.
Absolutely. And the hostels are full most of the time. And, you know, so there is absolutely nowhere for these folk to go.
Well, what would you like to see happen then?
Oh, we think that there ought to be a council-delivered service which was accessible to everybody. And there was one until last year at the Compass Centre, but the funding for that finished and the service closed.
But the council will say that there's other agencies that are now doing this.
There are other agencies delivering other services, but nobody is delivering direct access.
Now, what does this actually mean for homeless people on the ground?
It means that you have to be referred to hostel accommodation by one of the professional workers. And if you don't get referred, or if you can't catch them, or if, you know, the system doesn't work for you, then you are there on the streets, no matter how cold it is, no matter how wet.
That was Paul Hazelden from Crisis Centre Ministries, which have a Wild Goose Cafe down in City Road. Now, Anthony, as this is part of your portfolio, does the council actually prioritise street homeless?
It's an issue that I've asked for a briefing on, and I do know that the figures have been going down considerably over the last year or two. I'm also getting reports that the partnership working side of things, where we actually work with other agencies to do this, is a more effective way than actually setting up centres, which is, I think, part of the reason why the Compass Centre went the way it did. But we are, I think we should be seen as an organisation that identifies a problem and tries to engineer a solution through existing agencies, and also act as a organisation of last resort. So we need to be a lot cleverer in how we identify these problems and how we administer them, but we also need to pick up the final problems which are not being resolved, and that's something we need to concentrate on.
So do you think we can do anything about this fact that we've got two nights a week where there is no proper hostel accommodation in the city?
If that is the situation, then I should know about it, and I'm afraid it's one of the things that I have not caught up with. I have a mountain of papers, and I've only been in post for 3 weeks, as you know. It's something that I have to look at. It's certainly on my radar to go through.
Okay, thanks very much. On to another story now, and resisting war crimes is not a crime. This is really one for you, Martin. This is a trial which is beginning next week on June 7th at Hove Crown Court. More than 1,400 Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces between December the 27th and January the 18th, 2009. That was the invasion of Gaza. And this is something which has come out of that. Some Bristol activists were involved in closing down, as they call it, decommissioning an arms factory near Brighton, which was apparently and allegedly sending missile parts over to go into Israeli missiles. Martin, can you just tell us a bit about this trial and what's behind it?
Yeah, I mean, some of the activists involved in this are from Bristol. I'm thinking of Ornella and Harvey in particular, but it's not just them. During the attack last year on Gaza, they decided to take action. They broke into the factory at the EDO factory at Brighton. They did a considerable amount of damage. They're going on trial on Monday. The beginning of the trial is on Monday. Some people are actually going down to support them. The judge has said that they will be allowed to offer a defence of greater harm, as it were. That they were taking that action in order to prevent a greater harm. They will argue that they were not committing a crime. That in actual fact what they did was proportionate to the greater harm that was going to be done by these missiles being sent to Israel. Now that's quite important, because in the past, when activists broke into Fairford a few years ago, they were not allowed to use that defence because it was argued that war and peace were matters for the British government, and therefore they couldn't argue that. So they actually argued about criminal damage, but this won't be a criminal damage charge. Like the trial of the Raytheon 9 in Belfast, it will be about the politics of it'll be basically a political argument in the courtroom. So we'll have to see what happened. The Raytheon 9 in Belfast got off. The jury decided that they were in fact in the right. I suspect a jury in Brighton might be similarly inclined, but we'll see.
Okay, that's one to watch for next week. Final story, though, is The Moneyless Man. The book is being launched in Bath. Imagine a year without spending or even touching money. Former businessman Mark Boyle did just that, and here is his extraordinary story. He goes back to basics and follows his own strict rules. Mark learns ingenious ways to eliminate his bills and discovered that good friends are all the riches you need. Well, that's a little bit irritating. He's just going around to his friends to get money. But what do you think about this? Is this a good idea, and would you recommend the idea of trying to become a moneyless man, Anthony?
Oh, I don't know about moneyless. I mean, money's been around for a fairly long time, and I think it's probably here to stay. But we should certainly be a lot more wise about how we use it, and probably a lot more wise about how we use our friends, I suspect, as well, rather than just milking them. So there may be a lesson there too.
I think this is part of a kind of cultural revolt against the consumer society, and in a sense is to be welcomed. But I think the idea of a moneyless society is largely illusory. But of course, you can move towards increasingly providing things for free for people. For example, the basis of the National Health Service is that things are provided for free and no money changes hands. And that's a very important principle. And we could, you know, education is provided for free. We need to move towards a society where lots of things are provided for free, because that's actually cheaper and more efficient than paying for it. That, of course, we still have to have a wealth-generating economy to generate the surpluses from which we can then run all these things which improve the quality of life without money.
So okay. True.
And we'll be hearing more about this next week, because we're joined after 6 o'clock on next week's show by some representatives from the Monetary Reform Party. Well, it's coming up to time for the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest, who's Liberal Democrat Councillor for Cotton and Cabinet Member for Strategic Housing and Regeneration, Anthony Negus. After the news, we have the two Bristolians caught up in Gaza. We hear from an expert on the media coverage of the conflict. And it's the annual Bilderberg weekend. Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.